So while Jack is coming up to the podium, I'd like to give a little commercial for the Liahona Children's Foundation. I'm a walking commercial for them. For the past 8 years, or 8 to 10 years, the Liahona Children's Foundation has been addressing malnutrition among Latter-day Saint children in the developing world. Some of you might be surprised to know that there are 125,000 malnourished LDS children. Here. So, back to my commercial.
Good. There you go, Wes. Super.
We have a booth out here that you might want to drop by and visit. So, malnutrition is a serious problem for LDS children in the developing world. And the good news is that for $70, the foundation can provide all of the nutritional supplements for a child for an entire year. For $70. And the other day I was trying to count the number of times I go to the refrigerator and the pantry in my house. And where I travel in the developing world and know many people who don't have pantries or refrigerators or stoves or food to cook on them, it gives me pause for the dramatic difference between the world most of us live in and what many of our brothers and sisters in the developing world live in. So stop by our booth, and if you feel so inclined, think about them. So I begin with the second commercial, which is the announcement of Dialogue's 50th Jubilee Celebration, which will take place on September 30th at the Utah History Museum. There are only a very few seats left, and I know people say this when they have thousands of seats and say, you know, and wait, one more thing we can give you, and if you do it right now, but really there are only a few seats left, but there will be, this is on the 30th of September, on the 29th of September, there will be, or is it the same day, Boyd? Same day. At Utah Valley University, there will be a series of lectures and interviews. Darius Gray will be there. Marlon Jensen will be there. Boyd Peterson will be there. That's the big draw. Christine Durham. Christine and Darius and Marlon are being honored at the Jubilee celebration. You know, in the scriptures, in the Jubilee, all debts were forgiven in the 50th year. So if you come to the celebration, we forgive all of your debts. Anyway, stop at our booth. There's a booth out there as well. And that's the last commercial that I have. Some of you probably have attended some of the other celebrations of Dialogue's years. But this is a big one. 50 years. And so we have a panel of people. Come in, Marion. Have a seat. You look as elegant and beautiful as ever. So we have a panel of past editors. Not all of the past editors could come today. So one of the things that I asked them to do is to write, some of them to write a little reflection on their editorship. So this is Levi Peterson's. Among the books and magazines on my bookshelves are many in those productions in which I have been involved. These include books I have written and magazines and journals in which my stories and essays have appeared. And also prominent on one of my shelves are the 20 issues of Dialogue whose production I oversaw as editor from 2004 to 2008. At my present age of 82, I look back with gratitude on a busy and generally happy life. I have undertaken many roles. I belong to a large extended family. I've been a husband and father. I've had numerous loyal friends. I have long enjoyed a career as a professor of English at Weber State University. And finally, after retiring from full-time teaching at Weber State, I was honored to become editor of Dialogue for a 5-year stint. It was an undertaking that I approached with trepidation. I had recently moved to Issaquah, Washington, which seemed far removed from the centers of Mormon studies. Furthermore, I didn't lack for other things to do, as is true of all of the editors of Dialogue. All of us, none of us lack for better things to do. I was teaching 2 online writing courses, and also my wife Althea and I were much involved with our daughter's life. She and her husband were both working, and their 2 young sons required our daily supervision. Adding to my trepidation was a venerable tradition of Dialogue. For nearly 40 years, the journal had been foremost among venues which interpreted Mormonism from a perspective friendly to, yet independent from, the institutional church. Although I had served as acting editor for 2 other journals, the size of the Dialogue venture was daunting, requiring a large editorial staff, most of whose members lived far afield from me. Time proved my worries to be unfounded. It was true that except for occasional trips, I found myself obliged to work on Dialogue affairs 7 days a week, year-round, mingling my editorial labors with numerous other daily activities. Fortunately, the editorial staff was highly competent and conscientious. Thanks to email and the telephone, the distances between us proved irrelevant. Conveniently, the core of our production staff and the journal's business manager lived in Salt Lake City and could collaborate in person. I take particular pride in the fact that our 20 issues were in the mail, if not slightly ahead of, then only a day or two following our self-imposed deadline. A claim that editor Robert Reese could never make. Maybe 1 issue on time. I owe the success of our enterprise to the people on the editorial staff. I'm also grateful for the support and encouragement of the journal's board of directors. I'm grateful, too, for the wide range of scholars, writers, and artists from whom I requested evaluations and manuscripts. Certainly one of my chief satisfactions was the numerous friendships I formed with all of those persons of high intelligence and great goodwill. So that statement from Levi. Mary sent a statement, and she said, you know, just tell them that on the 20th anniversary I wrote an article, and it's called Big D and Little D, and they could read that. But, she said, I'll give you 1 paragraph or 2. She said, I would like to add that our staff used to read aloud to each other in order to catch typos. For example, Samuel Clemens, ex-slave, could have read Samuel Chambers' sex slave. So reading things out loud was really a good idea. She said, the feeling that Dialogue was edited by effete scholars who wished to change the church was totally wrong. We were like a family who cared for one another. Do you recall when we drove our kids out to BYU and included a trip to LA where we stayed in your house? You were out of town, and Gene and his son Mark were in our house in Virginia, and Gene called to say he and Mark were trying to get the Stanford game on TV, and we had to tell him that the cable hadn't yet reached us. This has led me down memory lane, so you don't have to use it all. Just pick out some stuff, okay? And then a note I got just this morning from Neil Chandler, who said, what did Neil say? Well, I guess it was a letter instead of So Neil said, editing Dialogue through a cascade of transitions was intense, time-swallowing, sometimes draining, always engaging, and a lesson in gratitude to all of the colleagues, noted and unsung, who over the decades have kept and yet keep the journal vital, significant, and present. Brevity is the soul of wit. So there are voices from 3 editors of Dialogue who are not here today, but fortunately others are. And so we have a panel consisting of Wes Johnson, who was one of the first editors, along with Gene. And I asked Charlotte to come and share her perspective on those early years when Dialogue was formed. I don't know about you, and some of you are not old enough to remember that, but I remember I was in graduate school and that first issue of Dialogue came with the two people sitting under a tree, and I sat down and read it from cover to cover, and I had immense hope and joy in my church. And I felt, okay, we've arrived. We've got something to really celebrate. So Wes and Charlotte will talk about those first years. I was a second editor, and I'll say something toward the end. Jack, were you the third?
No.
Who was the third editor?
Mary.
Oh.
Mary Graff. But for those who are here, we're next, yeah.
Okay. Martha, are you were next?
No, I was
asked to get. Okay. we're gonna forget chronology for now. We'll start with Wes and Charlotte, and then let's go down the line, starting Jack, and then Ross, and then Martha. And then I'll say a few words at the end if there's time, and we'll be prepared to answer any questions you may have. So, Jack and Charlotte, take it away.
Jack and Charlotte.
You mean me?
Wes. Wes and Charlotte.
Yeah. I'm honored, but you got the wrong guy.
Yeah, I did. That happens.
I have to have some help downstairs. Maybe I should just stay here.
Yeah, stay here. Okay, this works perfectly fine, but you'll have to hold it and speak close into it.
Can you hear me?
Get right to it.
Okay. Well,
there we go.
Okay. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I feel in a very jubilant mood after 50 years to see that this young thing that some of us spawned 50 years ago is still alive and seems to be in good shape and raring to go for in the future. It's also a pleasure to see the fact that this endeavor has had a tremendous impact on the Mormon community, leading the way for independent publications which are now all over the place, and which back in 1965 was not the case, when everything we read came from 40 East South Central or wherever, anyway, the church address. I can't remember it now. Anyway, and what I think it's important, I have several things to say today and go back. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm jubilant that I have been able to live until this time, 50 years after the fact, and jubilant that the future, I think, looks very good for Dialogue and for independent publications. When we started Dialogue, there was nothing else out there. There were one or two fly-by-night publications and anti-Mormon publications, but there was nothing solid out there that represented Mormon thought or Mormon history. And that's a niche that Dialogue aspired to fill, Mormon thought and Mormon history. That's where Gene comes in with Mormon thought and church dialogue, and me with Mormon history. So the two of us together then were able to get Dialogue underway. Let me share a few things for the next few minutes about how all of this started. Go back to Harvard, where I was an undergraduate, in the early 1950s. And there were a group of people in the Cambridge branch who got together and talked about different problems of the church and also how to remain strong in the church because some people were failing and falling away. And people like Richard Anderson were there, Truman Madsen was there, Richard Bushman was there, and numerous others, and I was there. And it was an entourage of faith and intellect, and so it was just the thing what if you were a young Harvard student like I was that I needed, and it was really great, good foundation. Okay, fast forward. During the time I was at Harvard, I was very lucky to be elected to the Harvard Lampoon, the oldest humor magazine in the United States, to become an assistant editor to John Updike, who was editor of the Lampoon for several years. Now, I know that sounds strange if you know what the kind of stuff John Updike wrote. Let me say this. John Updike was probably the person of greatest genius I've ever met. The guy was a genius. He was flawed morally, and unfortunately his writings show those flaws. But as an editor and as a friend, as a human being, he was a great guy. And I was under his wing then to learn about how to run a journal, how to run a magazine, to do all the different things you do to make a magazine come out on time every month. I did that for 3 years working with John Updike. So I give a vote of thanks to him, even though his record, literary record, is not the literary record I necessarily share. But he's a great editor, okay. So fast forward then to a bit later when I was in graduate school. Before I went to graduate school, I was still at Harvard. Why? We made a man named Walter Whitehill an honorary editor of the Lampoon. He said, Wes, I want you to meet a friend of mine who is a book designer and so forth for Alfred A. Knopf. His name is Rudolf Ruzicka. He's one of the most brilliant type designer and book designer and magazine designers in the world. So I got to meet Rudolf Ruzicka and became a friend of his, and we went every month to the Odd Volumes Club, which is a group of literati in Cambridge, in Boston. And so I got to know something about bookmaking and typography. In particular, Ruzicka had designed a number of Alfred A. Knopf's books. That got me very much interested in getting into doing some kind of quality printing in the future, some kind of work. I didn't know quite where I was headed, but I knew I was headed somewhere. Okay, fast forward. Then when I got in graduate school at Columbia, I also had wonderful experience. I was in charge of lectures for the history department, and we had numerous scholars who'd come in and talk about history and publishing. And finally, Alfred A. Knopf himself showed up and joined me for dinner afterward in a rousing conversation of several hours, and talked to him about Updike and talked to him about book publishing and magazine publishing. It gave me a great incentive to look at the fine kind of books he was producing. He was probably, I think, by acclamation in those days, and even today, the stuff he did was probably in a class all by itself. Okay, then I leave for a Mormon mission, okay? And I go to France. And this was very happy for me because I'd studied French, and I was delighted to go there. How does this intersect with dialogue? Well, when I got there, I found out some of my friends from the Harvard Lampoon had started a new intellectual review called the Paris Review. And so I was in Paris as a missionary, and they were there starting this new review. And they said, hey, can you come and help us? I said, no, I have other responsibilities here. But I envied them and looked in on what they were doing to start a review, which is still alive today, which is a very distinguished humanities and literary review. And some of my friends started this. George Plimpton was the prime mover. And I kind of looked in on them. I wasn't part of them. I was a missionary. I kept to myself. But on the other hand, I learned a lot from these guys, and it gave me the enthusiasm to think about, you know, really having some kind of a journal, some kind of a publication somewhere down the line. Okay, next vignette is I am a visiting fellow at UCLA, asked to give a big speech to a student conference. Original subject, and so I gave a subject on the need for an independent Mormon journal. And afterwards, people came up and said, this is great, can't we start right now? I said, no, I'm a visiting fellow, I don't stay here. Well, can't you come back here and start this? And I said, no, I'm going to Stanford, I can't come back here. Anyway, the point is, the enthusiasm that spilled over with all of those UCLA students with the idea of an independent journal coming out that would publish Mormon things that could not be published in the improvement era or elsewhere was an attractive idea. I went back to Phoenix where my family lived, and my mother said, hey, we're going to have a big swimming party. We had a big swimming pool. Phoenix is a hot place. You have to have a swimming pool. So I went there, and in my bathing suit, I sat next to Homer Durham, who had become president of the University of Arizona. Homer Durham was later church historian, one of vice president of the University of Utah, great figure in the church and in the state here, but also in Arizona. And I sat there then in my bathing suit around the pool talking to Homer Durham about the need for some kind of a publication. He became a mentor for me. I've tried to get him on the board of Dialogue, much as we persuaded Leonard Arrington and Lowell Bennion to come on, but he held off. But he said, "Look, I can be your Emmy non-squeeze. I can kind of coach you from the corner." And so he did. And every time I went to Arizona State and visited him, visiting my family, I'd check in with Homer. And as we moved forward with Dialogue, why, he was an invaluable person, very, very high-minded and very practical-minded. Okay, now let's go quickly to what happened. I then had been in Africa on a fellowship from the Ford Foundation, came back and got a fellowship to go to the Hoover Institution. And so to write up my dissertation on African politics, I came there. And we came to Escondido Village, a student village at Stanford, in 1965, the first part of 1965, and settled in there. And I worked on my dissertation for the Hoover Institution as time went on. We got to know people in the ward and various things. And one thing that overjoyed me was my former companion in the mission field, Paul Salisbury, who's from Salt Lake, but he was also a Stanford student, was there. And he and I used to talk about this idea of a Mormon publication of some sort. He was very interested because he was a person who had a tremendous eye for design. He was an architect. He knew what he was doing. And so we talked about various ideas. And one thing that came out of that discussion, which I think became a hallmark of Dialogue, and that is we said, if we ever do a publication, we want it to have class. We want to show the world that the Mormons have class. That may be trite, that may be corny, but that's one of the things we were talking about would be important for us to do, not to have a mimeograph bulletin, not to have a thing with a bunch of glossy photos in it, but to have something that looked like a real intellectual endeavor. And he and I both had read intellectual journals in France, and we had copies of these intellectual journals with us at Stanford. Yeah. Keep it close. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll go on very quickly. Anyway, the point is that we felt that there was a real possibility at Stanford. But what to do? How can you organize something like this? We knew the mechanics of printing. He and I both had had contacts with printers. 3 years I helped get all the printing done for the Lampoon. We knew all these things, but the question is, you've got to have an editorial presence. That's what was important. So there we were in the late spring of 1965, sitting around Escondido Village at Stanford talking about these. And a woman named Diane Monson, some of you who may know, was a professor at NYU. Diane Monson came through, and she said, old friends of Paul Salisbury and myself, and she said, "What are you guys doing?" And we told her, she said, "Oh, hey, have you talked to Gene England?" We said, "No, who's he?" "And you haven't met Gene England?" I said, "Well, no, I'm fairly new here." "Oh, you've got to meet Gene England. He's really something else. You know what? He's thinking about doing this too." I said, "You're kidding. We have rivals?" And she said, "Yeah, yeah." And so within a week or two, why, we got together, and Frances Menlov, who's not here, I guess. No, she's not here. Anyway, Frances Menlov lived in the Stanford compound where we lived, and she set up a meeting whereby Gene England and some of his friends and Paul Salisbury and some of our friends would come together, these two rival groups, to see whether or not we could become friends and perhaps merge, or whether we'd look at each other and, you know, become enemies. That didn't happen, happily, because we all, we didn't quite know, we didn't, each side didn't know everybody else, but we all became friends, had a wonderful evening, sat around, agreed to meet the next week and to talk about really the real possibility of starting a journal. And that was a wonderful meeting, those two meetings back in the spring, in May or June of 1965, And from that came the idea then of starting an original journal. And we then had meetings during the summer, subgroups to decide what we were going to do. We decided we wanted to have a very serious journal. We didn't want to have a glossy journal. We wanted to have the model I put forward was the model that eventually was dialogue was directly out of Paris. These are the kind of journals, serious journals, tremendously expensive paper, first-class typography, Baskerville type, and so forth, the kind of thing that people who are collecting books and magazines would want to take and say, hey, I'm proud of this. I'm going to put it on my shelf and collect it. That was our goal, to have class from the very beginning. Okay, now that's format. That's one thing. What's going to be inside? Well, that is where we had some differences of opinion. Joe Jepson, who was one of our friends, who was a friend of Gene's, and Joe was very combative. He wanted to take on the general authorities and different things. We can't do this. Gene toned him down, and he was a great guy, and he made a big contribution to dialogue, but you had to keep him on a tight rope. Okay, Frances Minlov was the conscience of the place. She wrote a wonderful article, The Challenge of Honesty, that still is part of the dialogue inventory today. And she had some very fresh ideas. Salisbury was an idea man. He had all kinds of ideas. And he agreed to be the point man for getting this thing published. Now, he and I had had conversations a month or two before with the Stanford University Press. By now, I was a professor. All these other people were students. I was a professor. And so I'd gone to the Stanford University Press to ask their ideas. They said, look, this is in the days when Stanford and LDS Church were like this. Okay. And so I went there. And the net result was that we agreed that if we could get this thing going, that Stanford University Press would be our publisher. Now, that was quite a consensus. I was astonished. But then, no, we want to help you guys. You know, this is a worthy endeavor. You know, you guys are doing the right thing. We want to help you every way we can. The university then, and I, as a new faculty member, I didn't have much clout. But the idea sold itself. I went to some of the professors. I went to the chairman of the department, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner, a Jewish historian. Wesley, this is a great idea. They arranged so that I had two more offices on campus where we could have meetings, where we could store things, and where we could have desks to work on this new publication. They paid for lights, telephones, typewriters. Stanford paid for all this. In other words, one of the main reasons we got going, because Stanford, this was all sub rosa. I mean, it was not advertised. I said, keep it quiet, you know, keep it quiet. So we did. But it meant then that when Gene and I finally got into action, why, we had a place, an office, and rooms to meet in. And so at that point, what we decided that, first of all, that Gene and I are the only ones who really had a lot of experience in running magazines. He had run The Pen at University of Utah. He was an experienced editor. And so by acclamation, they decided that we would both be managing editors. We'd be co-editors of this enterprise. And there are a number of things he did that were very important. I was able to get the office. I was able to get the support of Stanford. I was able to get the post office. I was able to get the post office box, the mailing permit, all this kind of stuff that only a faculty member could do at Stanford at this time. So I took care of those things. I also then was in charge of appointing an advisory board, which appears on the inside cover of the first issue of Dialogue. Can't read all these names, but there are people like Chase Peterson, Kent Lloyd, a number of people on here, very, very prestigious people who came in our editorial board. That was my job, was to recruit the editorial board. We had about 20 people we recruited from around the country, professors, businessmen, and a very prestigious board. And these people were friends, and they put their money on the line and their name on the line to help get this thing started. We made it clear that we were not just a bunch of wild students, but this was an endeavor of faculty and students, and that we had the support of the university. Not the endorsement, but we had the support of the university. What about the church? Well, no, we're independent. We're not seeking the endorsement. But that means you're anti-Mormon. No, it doesn't mean we're anti-Mormon. And this is one conversation we have the next 2 or 3 years. But if the church doesn't endorse you, you must be anti-Mormon. But we're not anti-Mormon. We're independent. Okay. So we go on from there, and Gene was able, I was able to mobilize the advisory board. Gene's job was to, I was kind of running the back office here and dealing with university affairs and dealing with the advisory board around the country. Gene's mission was, A, to mobilize the students on campus. We needed help to run this journal. Gene was teaching, what was he teaching? He was teaching... Western Civ. Well, no, he was teaching church education stuff.
Institute,
yeah. So Gene mobilized all these institute kids. I'm not sure they knew what they were doing, but they were delighted to come out to our rooms at Stanford. There's nice rooms and everything, and we had nice refreshments. And so as the year went, first year went on, why Gene was able to do a wonderful job in recruiting all of these students. So that was one of the first things that he did, which was really tremendous. Secondly, he had contacts in Salt Lake that I didn't. I was an outlander. And that's one reason I got involved in this journal, because coming from Phoenix, I'd always felt those of us who lived outside of Utah didn't have a voice in the church. And I felt strongly that if a dialogue were to go, it would be a voice for outlanders. That's what I was interested in. Anyway, so we got things going, and Gene was also in charge of having relations with the general authorities. I had contacts with the general authorities, but he had more contacts. So we both did it, but he was primarily involved because he was from Salt Lake. I was not from Salt Lake. I was a real outlander. And so we had our roles cut out for us of what we were doing. Now, how did we happen to come together? Well, I told you how we met at these informal parties. And the question is, how could we get along? Because we're both fairly willful persons. Some people say, these guys will never make it. They'll quarrel, you know, and it'll never work. Guess what? We never quarreled. Believe it or not, we never, I say this honestly, we never had an argument. It was an amazing, we're different persons, different points of view, different backgrounds, entirely different people, and yet we had we shared a central vision of a magazine that could bring the Mormon story not only to the Mormon public, the Mormon lay public, where they could express their feelings, but also to the grand public, the non-Mormon public, where they could hear the Mormon story. These are the two goals we had, speak to the Mormons and speak to the non-Mormons. And of course, some people said, oh, you guys want to argue with the general authorities. We said, no. We're not going to argue with the general authorities. In fact, we're going to give them free subscriptions to every magazine so they know what we're doing. And that turned out to be a good idea because they could keep their tabs on us. All they had to do was open up their subscription every month and find out what we were doing. So that's how we got underway, with Gene especially being able to, he had a more flexible schedule since he was a graduate student. He could go out and speak. He was invited to speak in Chicago, speak here or there, and speak to soirees, evenings. I was able to do that too. And some, I was a professor, I couldn't get away as easy as he could, but I went to New York and Chicago and San Francisco and other places to speak too. But Gene particularly had more time, and he was a rousing speaker, a magnetic speaker, some of you may remember, tremendously gifted speaker. And he really gave a vision, lifted up a vision of what we were doing, to taking it out of the kind of pedestrian, you know, here we are, we're grubbing around trying to publish this, peddle this little magazine. No, we had a mission of bringing Mormon thought and Mormon understanding not only to members of the church who had been disenfranchised from being able to speak, and anyway, and so that's what finally happened. I'll close in just a minute by saying this, that it was a terrific journey to work with all the people who helped Dialogue, found Dialogue. I was going to read their names, but we don't have time for that. But what I do want to read is, G and I both wrote lead articles in the first issue. I just want to read little excerpt from the article I wrote, and then we'll close. This is the lead article. Mormons have long remained isolated from their neighbors by choice and by necessity. Today is not the past, however, and most Mormons live outside of Utah. You see, that's me speaking, an outlander. I wanted the Mormons outside of Utah to have a voice. Los Angeles and New York are as important subsidiary centers of Mormon culture now as St. George and Nephi were 50 years ago. Today, it is not unusual to see Mormon congressmen in Washington, Mormon business executives in Chicago, and Mormon professors at Harvard, or Mormon space scientists at Houston. This is 1965, remember. Mormons are participating freely in the social, economic, and cultural currents of change sweeping across 20th century America. But Mormons do remain apart from the greater American society. Their experience, heritage, and tradition of years in isolation remain an integral part of Mormon belief. Mormon doctrine reinforces individual withdrawal and defiance of conformity in the face of modern convention. The new era of life in the secular world, far from the cloisters of a Rocky Mountain Zion, has created a host of dilemmas for the individuals who seek to reconcile faith and reason. And then I go on to say, a new generation of Mormons has arisen in this process of spreading about the land. Sorry, that was the message. Gene had messages, I had messages. As editors, we both had messages. This was part of my message as an outlander, and I felt a particular responsibility, especially as all the letters came in from across the country as dialogue was published. We got letters from every state in the Union, from Alaska and everywhere, and people said, we knew there were people like you out there. We knew that someday this would happen. We're just delighted it's happened now. And we felt like we had really touched upon a nerve that was ready for response. Okay, let me just say the last thing I want to say, that dialogue has been able to be continued because of, first of all, the tremendous amount of effort that Gene England put in, and Scarlett will be able to tell you more about that, but I want to pay homage to him for all of what he did and how he was such a wonderful co-editor. We had the most friendly relationship. It was a golden kind of relationship. The only thing I can call it. And I miss Gene very much, I think, as we all do. Secondly, I pay homage to Bob Reese, because towards the end, I was leaving Stanford. Gene had left Stanford the year before to go to Minnesota. I was still at Stanford holding down the fort, and Bob Reese appeared on the scene. We agreed that we would ship the magazine to UCLA. We worked with Elder Carmack, who was an attorney at that time, and he set up the Dialogue Foundation, and this gave us a lasting kind of institution to make sure that we are going to continue this magazine in the future. We are very interested in continuity. And we looked around, and there were considered three or four different people, but it became apparent that the man who had the hustle and the interest and the connections was one Bob Reese. He knew exactly what was going on. He flew up four or five times to Palo Alto and got himself immersed in the magazine to find out what was going and going on, so that we had really, maybe not a seamless transfer, but mainly almost a seamless transfer from Palo Alto down to UCLA. So I want to pay homage to Gene England and also to Bob Reese and to many, many others who I cannot mention, and to let you know that to me it's been a wonderful ride. It's something that I've been very proud of. I went on later in years to found another journal, The Public Historian for the University of California, which I edited for many years. So I have two journals that I've worked on. But Dialogue was always my favorite because we started with great obstacles. And you have no idea the obstacles we faced and the people who bad-mouthed us. People said, you can't succeed, you're going to become apostates. Let me tell you, the last thing I want to say is, Gene and I always feared that late-night phone call at 11 o'clock. This is a XYZ general authority. We want to tell you guys to cease and desist or else. Guess what? That call never came. It never came. And I think it never came because I think the general authorities, and I have this from several of them who were were very favorable to dialogue. You guys are putting out a quality publication. You were minding your P's and Q's. You didn't publish anything salacious, overly critical, and so forth. And so, you know, no wonder you never got that call. Now, there are other many critics and so forth. Anyway, that's what I have to say. And thank you for coming here, and thank you for listening.
What I'd like to do is, I mean, you heard this wonderful history from Wes, and others will give a history of the actual editing and working in the journal that way. And so I'm going to give you a little side snippets of things that were happening in our lives. Gene liked to surprise me, and he was good at it. And for most things, when I got on board, it turned out to be pretty exciting. And some of those things started with the first date. And I was just starting at the University of Utah, and Gene was dating girls in high school. I was going with his good friend in high school, and we double dated all the time. So I knew Gene quite well before I ever dated. So that was the first surprise that he called me. Then a year later, one morning, a Sunday morning, we'd been dating that year, and we wanted to go down to the choir broadcast, so we decided to go down a little bit early, and we're walking around the grounds. Now, this is before the big information center. This is before the old Bureau of Information Center, and then they had the growth in there, and then the temple was over here, and there was a little fence about 4 feet high that was around the temple on that one side. And there was a gate. And we're walking around, and Gene starts opening the gate. And I said, "I don't think we can go in there, can we?" And he said, "Oh, no, it's okay." And so I thought, well, he must know something I don't know. And all through our life, that was what I heard a lot of. Because I said, "I don't think we can really do that, can we?" "No, it's okay." And then I'd say, "I think he knows something I don't know." And then when I learned that that wasn't the case, I went along with it. The surprises never stopped. They just continued. So when they thought, when the talk was about a journal, we were living in Palo Alto, and more and more of that came up. And then, of course, you heard the history of when it finally gelled and got started. And at first, I said, "A journal?" I said, "Do you know how to put a journal together?" And then I thought that was kind of a silly question, because we had done so many things in our lives that we didn't know what it was going to be like, or what it was, it was new territory. But we did it, and we came out unscathed, pretty much. But we had done many things that we were going into new territory. You know, our marriage, our mission, off into the islands and building cabins and a recycled home. We didn't know how to do those things before we did them. And we found each of these things that we've done were so exciting. It was a new adventure. It was something that we, you know, had to figure out what to do and wondered if it would work. I remember when most of the activity was going on in the office that Wes described, but sometimes Gene would come. I remember one time they came home. What were they called? Galley proofs? Yeah. Is that? Okay. And I remember they were long, and I was reading this one of the essays that was going in there. It was called The Death of a Son. And a very, very tender story of a woman whose son is dying. And I began to realize that this was really going to come together. And we also had support from some people. Elder Haight at that time was our state president. And I remember talking to him outside the church one day, and he said, this is a great thing. This is really needed. I was so glad, and he encouraged us. And Hubie Brown was wonderful when we visit him. And he one time when he was not doing well, and his son Ed came by, and he said, Ed, I haven't seen my dialogue lately. I hope they didn't forget to mail it to me. I mean, people that we so respected, and Lowell Binion, I mean, these were mentors for us, and so it really gave us the courage to you know, do this venture. and after a while, as Wes was saying, that Gene was invited to different places around the Bay Area, to speak, and it was so interesting because we had had a rumor that came back to us after the first publication or so, and it was that Gene and I had left the church, had started our own religion, and were practicing polygamy, and our children were not in the church anymore, and of course our children were, you know, they were six kids under 10. So I don't think it really, I mean, it still wounded me. I just thought, how can anybody make up things like that? You know, it was just really horribly jarring to me that anybody could be so unkind and untruthful. So we soon, you know, I wouldn't say we got used to gossip like that, but it wasn't uncommon. And then, so anyway, when we would go around to the places in the Bay Area to talk about dialogue where people had invited him, and it was always so interesting because there were two groups of people there. One group who had never read dialogue had just heard things about dialogue and these dangerous people that had started it. And then there were others who were just hungry for it, and they were just so happy to have a contact with that. And so Gene would start out, and this is how most of his lectures went. It wasn't just this, but it was how he taught as well when he would teach gospel in class. And at first, you know, he'd lay out some things, and then they would be kind of startling maybe. And you could see some of the people kind of getting squirmy, And I just wanted to stand up and say, everybody just stay calm. It's all going to work out in the end. And so we'd get, then when he would get through with the lecture and they'd be coming up and they said, oh, you're so different than we thought you were. You know, we thought you were some kind of wide-eyed beast. And so it was a really great experience to meet people that way. And then I was so thrilled with it, and the design of it was so beautiful, and I loved that image of the two men sitting under the tree and talking. I thought that's how it should be all the time. I mean, that's if we could just sit under a tree and talk to each other, half of these problems wouldn't even be here. But I'm not running the show, so. But Gene was always trying to find a new way to create something, to write it, to teach it. It was his mind was just constantly going for the things that could make it a little bit better, so he could reach the people better. He was very, very caring about people, and he could contact them, and there would be this wonderful thing that would go on. I remember one time there was a family in our ward in Palo Alto, and he in front of the whole congregation, he criticized Gene for something. It was quite embarrassing, and was quite unkind. And so when we were going home, Gene, he just felt sick. And I said, you've got to go talk to him. And he says, I don't think he'll let me in the house. And I said, I think he will, you know. So he did. He went over, and it's about 3 or 4 hours later, he came home. And they were made home teachers together. I mean, this is how this dialogue and this conversation and everything breaks down these barriers that are so, it's just so incredible. And I just wish we had more of that. Then, and of course, we thought we were there permanently. We had bought this big old hulky Victorian house that needed a lot of work on it, and we were doing it. And then, when we finally finished it, it took us about 3 years. Then he got a call from one of his, Gene was a Danforth fellow, and there are other fellows who were there from the other states, and one of them was from Minnesota at St. Olaf College, and he had gone back home. Anyway, he got a call. We got a call. And he said, Gene, they're looking for somebody to be academic vice president at St. Olaf. Would you come and interview for the job? And he said, I don't want to be in administration. I want to teach. And he said, well, they could probably give you a teaching position along with the other. And Gene said, well, I'll come and look. We thought we were settled in the house we were going to live in and die in. We thought it was forever. And so in one weekend, our lives changed. And Gene went back, interviewed, and then he sent me with our oldest daughter, who was just turning 12 at the time. Anyway, she was just going into middle school. And, you know, that's a hard age to have a kid pulled out. So we did it and took the job. We loved it. It was a small college town. And it was a time to hand it over. And that was hard. Knowing that we wouldn't be doing this the rest of our lives for dialogue, it was really hard. But we knew it was in very capable hands when Bob took it. And he was familiar with it, and we knew him, and we had great faith in how he was going to take over. I just want to read a little four-liner here that Ron Fredrickson said he had written years ago on Gene. And this sums up really what Gene, his intentions were. The late revered Gene England helped saints with scholars mingle, and some say their minds became unclogged the moment they were dialogued.
That's me. Thanks, Bob.
Take the microphone.
Thank you, Charlotte. And Wes, just great. That'll be fine. Thank you. So Linda and I, now there's a gap. Bob Reese was editor for about 5 years, and then Mary Bradford was the editor with the strong assistance of Lester Bush. So the Dialogue Center was first on the West Coast, and then Mary Bradford and her team were in Washington, D.C., so was East Coast. So both of those teams, I believe, decided it was probably time for Dialogue to come to Utah because the concentration of talent to support and edit the journal would apparently be much richer out here. So there was a lot of anxiety about that, because if you bring Dialogue right to Salt Lake City under the nose of the church, could it maintain its independence? It might have more talent to draw on, but could it do what it needed to do? To make a long story short, Linda and I were finally invited to serve as the editors of Dialogue. She was in the middle with Valley and Every of writing the biography of Emma Smith, Mormon Enigma, and I was much involved here at the university. And I suppose her credentials for editing Dialogue are quite clear, having gained quite strong stature as an historian. My credential, I think, primarily that suited me for this had to do with that context of coming to Salt Lake City. And that is, my field of study is the history and philosophy of universities. And academic freedom has always been one of the key things that I've focused on in terms of the history of universities. It is, in a sense, the essential value of higher education. And so that seemed to fit very nicely. Linda and I would not say, like others here, like Wes and Gene, you never had an argument. Linda and I had plenty of arguments. but not always about dialogue.
Or a little closer.
That's right. Oh, I'm sorry. But we assumed the editorship in the summer of 1982. And dialogue, therefore, was only 16 years of age at that time. It was still something of an experiment. I think it was not altogether clear that dialogue was here to stay. The context, however, was the Arrington Spring, and that is Leonard Arrington, about 5 years before this, had become the church historian, the first professional historian ever to preside over the history department of the LDS Church. And if he had not flung the doors of the archives open, he had certainly opened them rather wide. And therefore, we had an outpouring of scholarship based on access to Mormon historical documents like they had never been available before. And so much of the period that Linda and I edited a dialogue was marked by the fact that there was an outpouring, particularly in the area of history, of new scholarship, which was highly controversial because the archives revealed things that there were many who were not pleased to have them aired in public. So we had several major issues that came up during our editorship. The first was an article that had been written by David Berger on the second anointing. And David Berger had been interested in this topic for a long time. He had originally proposed the manuscript to Mary Bradford and her editorial team, and they said there are a lot of problems here. You've got to work much more on it. So we inherited a manuscript in preparation and spent a lot of time with David working to perfect it. The second anointing, if you're not familiar with it, is a temple endowment, which is in addition to one's initial temple endowment, very sacred and largely secret, which, for those who receive it, is a promise of eternal glory. Hence, it's, I suppose, for those involved, very sacred, but also something which has not generally been advertised as a practice of the LDS Church. So it became clear as David Berger's article was, as we were working it toward a level of publication, that there were pressures coming from the church. He had let a couple of general authorities know that he was working on this. One was supportive, one was looking askance at it, but before long, we had Marky Peterson, who was then an apostle of the church, beginning to call in writers for dialogue. This is all a part of the larger set of concerns regarding the opening of the archives. And so a number of writers for dialogue in Sunstone were challenged for their membership and for their temple recommends just for having written independent scholarship about the LDS Church. So this was occurring with regard to a number of writers, and Boyd K. Packer, then a prominent apostle, gave a talk in General Conference saying that anyone who would publish sacred things on the church should fear for their membership. Those were not his exact words. I can't recall what they were, but that was the essence of it. So our editorial team had a moment of truth, I guess we would say, with the Berger manuscript in 1983. And that is, would we succumb to the challenge to the independence of dialogue and pull the manuscript, or would we proceed with the publication of it? And we met every other week in our living room on Tuesday evenings, and our editorial team, like Mary described in her remarks that were read to us, was very much like family, and we had a very fundamental conversation about this manuscript, which involved several members of the editorial team saying, well, we would be glad to withdraw from our position with dialogue if the rest of you want to proceed. And we said, well, we don't want to move on that kind of a basis. It went on for hours, and finally the editorial team all agreed unanimously we should proceed with this. But our principles were very clear, and that was that we would make absolutely certain that there were that the facts stated in the article could be verified backwards and forwards, and that the argument that was set forth by David Berger about the second anointing would be made in such a way that he was not extending beyond the knowledge that he presented as the basis for the article. and that we would try to keep our sense of humor about a very serious situation. So we proceeded with the publication of David Berger's article on the second anointing, and in fact, nothing happened. And we were very pleased and breathed a sigh of relief. The dialogue basically had survived a rite of passage, I think, in terms of establishing its independence. As you know, Dialogue publishes great art, poetry, personal essays, serious history, sociology, almost every perspective that you can imagine about Mormonism. We publish those things. But a second article based on the Arrington Spring and the opening of the archives was our second big test. And that was an article by Michael Quinn about polygamy that was authorized secretly by the general authorities of the church after the manifesto in 1990, where the church said that it had eschewed and had foregone the practice of polygamy. Again, a very hot topic. This time there were even more threats to us as the editors, veiled, but coming to us quite clearly nonetheless, as well as to Michael Quinn. We followed the same principles that we had the first time, and we published the article. And this time there was a more serious consequence, and that is that Michael Quinn had been a distinguished professor on the BYU history faculty, and it didn't happen right away, but the movement became quite clear, and he was ultimately relieved of his post at BYU and forced to leave the professorship there. I would be glad to. Thank you for asking me to do that. That's all the time I'm going to take now, except to say that during our editorship as well, Linda's book on the on Emma Smith with Val Avery had come out. It was recognized very nicely. Doubleday published it, and then 6 months after its coming out in June 1985, while we were the editors, the church came down on Linda and Val and announced that they were not permitted to speak anywhere in a church forum about their book. The thing that made it most difficult was that the church did not tell them that. The church circulated word to bishops and stake presidents that they were not to be invited under any circumstance to talk in church. And then another event that occurred during our editorship was Mark Hoffman with his bombs killed two people in Salt Lake City and ultimately killed himself when his third bomb went off. We still don't know who it might have been intended for. And maimed himself. So the last thing I would say, I guess, about our editorship was that we were very much, with all of these events, in the public eye. And Linda and I counted over 40 interviews that we had with reporters from the New York Times, the Detroit Free Press, the Louisville Courier-Journal, Denver Post, Los Angeles Times. These things just seemed to rain down on us. And I think one of the reasons is that we try to give reporters honest responses to questions and yet be as uninflammatory as we could be. So now we end what I've got to say here. Right out this end of the building, where there's a little plaza between here and the Student Services building. And at the time, Obertanner had given yet another fountain, and there was a grand opening, unveiling of the fountain, and authorities from the LDS Church were invited to come, community members, the mayor, and university faculty and staff. So Linda and I went to this event, and lots of people were milling around. They turned the fountain on and so forth, and Gordon B. Hinckley, who was then a member of the First Presidency of the church, we kind of circulated and bumped into him, and we had a nice conversation with him. And he said, before we parted, as you do in those kind of situations, he said, I want to thank you, too, for all the good you do. And as we drifted away, I said, isn't that interesting? He doesn't actually know who we are. But he was still very nice to us. That was on a Friday night. On Monday, we get the mail and slice open an envelope from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And there is a personal letter from Gordon B. Hinckley, in which he says, it was so nice meeting you at the unveiling of the Tanner Fountain, and so forth, and he ended with the same line that he had said to us there, thank you for all the good you do. A very pleasing end to a torturous period of editing dialogue.
we loved it. It was a fabulous part of our careers.
Jack, I don't think I ever got one of those letters. My name's Ross Peterson, and my wife Kay and I had the privilege and honor of accepting the editorship of Dialogue after Lyndon Jack Newell, 1987 to 1992. I should mention that when Jack was talking about his choice of professions, and I'm a trained historian. My wife's degree's in American Studies. In 1965, when I was leaving to go to graduate school, I went to one of my professors, Leonard Arrington, and said, I've selected this school. I'd just like a few ideas maybe on a possible dissertation topic. And I left with 42 topics written on my acceptance envelope. But the one thing he asked me, he said, now, do you want to be a Mormon historian or what? I said, no, I don't want to be a Mormon historian. I'd really like to get a job. And he said, no, seriously. And then he told me in that meeting in 1965, and I've looked at this later in both his journals and his records, but up at USU's library, he told us about the formation of Dialogue, that it was going to be coming. What he was saying is there's going to be places to publish things. And he talked about Dialogue, what was going on there. He talked about the Mormon History Association that was in its infancy and the potential of a Journal of Mormon History. And he talked about also his work with Western historians that eventually evolved into the Western Historical Quarterly and the Western History Association. Now, that just tells you a little bit about Leonard and how he was a mentor and he helped people. And I think Linda would say in their work on Emma Smith during the time that Jack described, Leonard was great at those things. He was also sometimes really, really naive, except in 1987, when the things that Jack had been describing were going on, especially the thing relative to Lyndon Valeen's book, as well as some of the other interviews and questions that were happening, a decision to ask LDS employees in the church education system to not participate in Dialogue and Sunstone. When Leonard got the rumor, by then he had left the church historian's office, was occupying the red chair down at BYU. He called me and said he didn't think it would be a good idea right now for Kay and I to take this editorship. He felt that there were storm clouds intellectually on the horizon, and they were already being reflected in some very serious lightning attacks. And so, we had to find out for ourselves, really. And the one thing that, I mean, we found out many things in the 5 years that we edited Dialogue. Number one, the Newells left it in fantastically great shape, not only with their work, but especially with Levina and Suzette Fletcher Green, because they had put together here in Salt Lake City an amazing group of volunteer editors, people who would go over those first drafts and help a lot with the editing work that Charlotte and Wes described. There were other things that the arrangements were very, very good. They had a facility with free rent down at Wally Cooper and Alan Roberts' architectural office. And so consequently, we originally made the decision that we would keep the basis of the journal here in Salt Lake City near the publisher, near the editors, where there was so much of a staff already in place, and that I applied for sabbatical, and then we came down here, and Jack was gracious enough to get me a couple teaching classes up at the University of Utah. I should mention, in all honesty, that when I think back, and I went back and looked at all the tables of contents and all the articles and the Berger thing, the Quinn thing, some of the ones that we did, the thing that I take out of Dialogue after all these years are the people that became our friends. And sometimes it was through a fiery furnace. Other times it was just unbelievably passionate volunteers and people that one of the great legacies that came out of dialogue, there are many, I think, but that we tried to enhance the concept of the personal essay, where people bear their souls, and you know, and I think in all respects, those were the hardest ones to reject as an editor, because people were really putting themselves out on the line, and a professional article, you know, one based on history or some theological thing that I've always wanted to throw theology out the window, but anyway, other people had more sense than I, but still, I think those personal essays, and then from my perspective, the contributions that the journal made in the articles that accepted relative to the origins of racial policy and then the treatment of women and the story of women and the ability of dialogue to allow many, many creative women artists, writers to have a voice as Correlation was taking the Relief Society magazine out of existence. And so I think in those areas, those are many of the things that I'm proud of and proud of the shoulders that we were able to stand on and hopefully the continuing foundation that we left for Marty and Alan and Gary. But for us, it was a tremendous ride. I think when I think of all the work that went in, and then I think back of the two decisions that we made that I anguished the most about. And it wasn't about second anointings, and you know, I came from a bunch of post-polygamous things, so I'd just blown that off a long time ago. But anyway, the two things that bothered me the most that I anguished over, and they came out of the recession of 1987. The Newells left us in very, very good financial shape with a good base of subscribers and the beginnings of an endowment. And then the stock market crashed pretty deeply, and our editorial board, the publisher, and everybody got together and made two suggestions. And it took me and Kay and our board about a year and a half to finally just say, okay. One was to change the size of the journal, and the second was to go from hot lead type to admitting that computers had value. And when we went to the artist who did the type, that was my lowest point in 5 years at Dialogue, to say we, like the University of Utah Press, like the Journal of Mormon History, all of them, we're going to leave him high and dry. And, you know, I can take them taking my recommend for a while, that other things that happened during those years and the you know, some of the battles we may have had it with different people of different persuasions, but that personal thing of looking a man in the eye who is an artist and saying we too are going to submit to the power of the lack of dollars right now, and of course that comes because Dialogue was a family, and the people that had supported, that put it together, those type of things, you just never release those relationships, because many of you went through a variety of refiners fire together, and so, but I have to admit that of all the one thing, the journal that I enjoyed the most was one of the very first one that we were involved in, and it had to do with the one that featured Minerva Tykert. Jack talked about artists, but Minerva was from my home area. I had known her my whole life, and it didn't seem to me that anyone appreciates a great artist till they die. And I just was so thrilled to be part of that particular publication. And so we thank you, Marion. But anyway, you were involved in that and in writing the article about her. And so anyway, Dialogue continues to be a family. And as many of you know, Jack and Linda have not been able to ditch us. We had the privilege of following them at Deep Springs College, and Jack and Linda have spent over 14 years of their lives in that lonesome valley, which is not lonesome, nor does it lack for things to do. And now Kay and I have spent 5.5 years there after the last half year. And so that is a dialogue in and of itself. But we have those types of friendships are what we have taken. And that is the thing Kay really wanted me to emphasize. So thank you.
I'm going to have to pretty much, yay, you did it.
All right.
I think you all can hear in the way we've all talked about our experience at Dialogue that those of us who edit Dialogue tend to be idealists. We go in believing that we can do everything and that this journal will be perfect and every article will be the perfect choice and every editorial decision will be sound and pure. And, you know, that spirit of idealism is absolutely necessary to take this on because it's putting yourself in the middle of a fire that you can't even imagine when you start out. And I think that's one of the other themes that you've heard. And no one straight up said it that way, right? But in every single one of the statements that have been made so far, there's some reference to the moments when you're the editor of Dialogue, when pretty much everyone around you disapproves of what you're doing or questions the kind of person you are, the kind of Mormon that you are, or the kind of editor that you are being. It's a high-stakes game, and it just kind of comes with it. The rewards are rich, even though I think the price is really, really high. I think it's really quite wonderful that for 5 years of your life, you're just up to your eyeballs in Mormon studies. And I think those of us who love language and love writing and believe that writing helps us to communicate stuff that's really deep inside of us, that's really hard to talk about or to express, but that we, for some reason, have this desire to share it with other people, I think that's very much at the heart of the enterprise. For Alan Roberts and Gary Bergera and me, we also brought our activist selves into Dialogue, and it was quite wonderful to have Jack talk about his administration, their administration and Dialogue in the way that you did, referencing Packard's comment. And it very much set the stage for both Ross and Kay's time in Dialogue and certainly ours. It wasn't a neutral context at all. And regardless of what our hopes were, our deepest desires of what we hoped to accomplish with Dialogue, it always was in some ways tainted or overshadowed by that larger context of what was going on. When I read the schedule for the symposium this morning that'll be held on September 30th, it struck me that one of the things I like most about Dialogue, and it's frustrating in some ways, but it's also quite wonderful, is that Dialogue has this sort of flexible or supple or malleable boundary around it. It's not just one thing. You can't have a symposium where you're describing all day long the same thing because Dialogue has shifted in its meaning. It's certainly shifted in the type of articles or the essays or the poetry that it has published. And I think in a really important way, it has responded to the modern world, and maybe it's just the modern world of Mormonism, but I think that's how it stays relevant. It's not this finite set of expectations or ideas ideas about Mormonism. It shifts as Mormonism and the issues it provokes in the modern world shifts as well. I think one of the things I love about Dialogue and independent publications around Mormonism is that it really helps us foster scholarship among young people. I think Dialogue is a fantastic place for older people like us to publish, but it also is a really great place for young scholars to get published and to become experienced with getting a critique of their work. One of the things I was thinking as you all were talking was on some levels, it sounds simpler than it is. Like, people submit an article and then it goes into production, but it actually is really, really, really complicated. And you deal with authors who are sometimes easy to work with and willing to change, and sometimes will just fight you and, you know, are so hyper-entitled and stubborn about their work that, I mean, every decision about what is published in Dialogue is one that is so thoughtfully and deeply reflected on. Alan and Gary and I didn't fight, but we would fight for what we believed was important to publish, and we would argue it into the ground, and we would anticipate our critics because we felt like we were surrounded by critics, and we wanted to make sure that we could defend our choices and that they always be sound choices. I feel like one of our big contributions was giving, and I'm sure we all feel this way, but giving voice, and I love the way you said this, the voice of Outlanders. I think that that's what we did as well. There are so many Mormons who are on the margin or on the edge and feel like they're never being recognized or valued or respected, and I think we gave voice to a lot of people on the margins in a really important way. I think we confronted difficult issues during our time in Dialogue. I think we, and Ross didn't want to go down through a list of all the amazing articles we all published, but I'd like to mention a few. We published George Smith's The Nauvoo Roots of Mormon Polygamy, which most recently became his book-length study of Nauvoo polygamy. We published Michael Quinn's Male-Male Intimacy Among 19th Century Mormons, a case study, and I cannot tell you how long we talked not only among ourselves but with our editorial board and a larger group of people about the advisability of publishing that. It went through multiple edits, but I think a really, really important first path-breaking work on that topic. We published Levina's The LDS Intellectual Community and Church Leadership, a Contemporary Chronology, in our very first issue, which, you know, we were just surrounded by criticism around that. I'm still very proud of the decision to publish that and support Levina's very interesting ongoing work. And then finally, The Similarity of Priesthood and Masonry, Michael Homer's, I think, path-breaking article, The Relationship Between Freemasonry and Mormonism. And again, that now is a book-length study. I thought I would just mention really briefly, and I know we're out of time, what I loved about it. because, I mean, it really is something, it's so complex and complicated, but you just love it. I really loved going to all the conferences around Dialogue, MHA, the Sunstone Symposiums, both in Salt Lake City and in Seattle and D.C. I loved feeling like I knew everybody who was doing Mormon studies. And, you know, it's just bewildering to me to walk through this conference today and know hardly anyone, you know, so many of the young faces and the new faces. I used to feel like I knew everyone who was doing this work, and we would always be courting them and trying to get them to submit. I loved that. My very favorite part of Dialogue was, though, choosing the artwork, and I took that so very seriously. And almost all of the artwork that we chose was work that had, and, you know, I'm just speaking for myself in this, but it personally affected me. And I'm with Linda Newell. Art communicates to me on a deep level in ways that writing doesn't. And so I always thought that the art in the cover was another way of speaking to deep truths around our religious experience. So I'm with all of you. I think it was one of the greatest honors and privileges of my professional career. I made lifelong friends. We were so privileged to, you know, and maybe the personal essays are where you heard this most, but you really are sharing the experience of men and women in their most private, intimate experience of trying to understand their relationship to each other and to their God. And again, I feel like we really made a difference.
I think this demonstrates what a fellowship there is among those of us who've been privileged to work on Dialogue. I just wanted to say very briefly at the end that to me it was just simply a great joy to be the editor of Dialogue and to both inherit it and pass it on. Each of us have had the privilege of being in that place and in that chair when important things happened. The three things that I identify very quickly, one is a women's issue. I'm very proud of the fact that we published that issue, that great pink issue, and so many gave voice to so many women and really began, I think, and opened up so many feminine voices that have been so important. The second one I'm proud of is that I published, or we published, during my editorship, the first essay by a gay Latter-day Saint. It was called Anonymous, but it was the first one in which there was an authentic gay voice speaking to a community that was not accepting of gay people. I was walking here a couple of years ago, and someone came up to me and said, "You don't know me, do you?" And I said, "No." He said, "I was anonymous." And it was very touching to me to have him say that. A third, of course, was Lester Bush's great and powerful and foundation-shattering article on the history of blacks and the priesthood. When Lester's article came across my desk, I was aware that I was in the presence of something very important. And it was very controversial to publish it. As you know, if you've read that, I was threatened with possible excommunication for doing so. But it turned out to be the kind of thing that Dialogue has done so well. It was not polemical. It laid out the history in such a way that it was impossible for people to argue with it. A story that I will tell very quickly. We wanted to promote it after we made the decision of, as an editorial board to publish it, and we got Gene and Gordon Thomason and Hugh Nibley to write responses to it, so it wasn't just a single voice, but it was a voice within the frame of Dialogue, which Dialogue is so famous for. And we wanted to advertise it, but we knew this was very tricky, so I got David Willardson, who was a great graphic designer, to develop a very powerful ad. It was a picture of a black man dressed in a suit, looking with the kind of confidence that is notable for the Renaissance, when the Medici and those people looked out at the world with great confidence. And here was a black man, and the caption underneath it was from a member of the Quorum of the Twelve: "Darkies are wonderful people, and they have a place in our church." Spoken by Joseph Fielding Smith, who later became president of the church. And that ad, I knew it was going to be controversial, so we wanted to get it in the Daily Universe and in the Chronicle. So I wrote ahead and reserved space for this ad, which was just a beautiful ad. It won awards. It won two awards in design, advertising design. And I got them to hold space, but I said to people at the Universe and at the Chronicle, the ad is coming, but it'll be late, so we want to meet your deadline. But I got somebody to hand-deliver it, and I got it hand-delivered right at the midnight hour. But in both instances, somebody saw it and said, "Oh, we can't do this." And so I wrote an essay called The Story of an Article, of an award-winning article that never ran. I wish that it had, but it represented, I think, that ad, both where blacks are today in the church, which is with dignity, with power, with voice, and that 19th century sentiment: darkies are wonderful people, and they have a place in our church. And I am grateful that it is no longer our church speaking of whites to blacks or Muslims to somebody else or women to men, but the Church of Christ, which Dialogue has played a very important role in giving voice to those expressions of variety and of diversity and of beauty and of meaning and of responsibility in a way that truly created dialogue amongst ourselves and between ourselves and God. Thank you.